Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A Nobel surprise, a war council struggle on Afghanistan this week, and NASA blasts the moon. The Nobel Peace Prize announcement from Oslo took nearly everyone by surprise.
The Nobel Peace Prize for 2009 is to be awarded to President Barack Obama for his extraordinary efforts to strengthen international diplomacy and cooperation between peoples.
At the White House, long days of wrestling over troop levels for Afghanistan. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said the president has a tough decision.
He made it very clear he's not going to rush into this, but he's not going to be leisure about it at all.
And NASA blasts the moon, hoping to kick up some evidence of water, ice. Here's Mission Control as the spacecraft slams into the lunar surface and has LOS, loss of signal, at impact.
Shepherding spacecraft impact. Stations report LOS.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. Joining us today from New York is Chrystia Freeland, U.S. Managing Editor of the Financial Times. Chrystia, great to have you back. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Tom.
We may be joined in a minute by Jonathan Martin at Politico. We are joined from Hanover, New Hampshire, by On Point News Analyst Jack Beattie, Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Chrystia.
And here's this news out of Oslo. My goodness, very early in the morning, U.S. time. Chrystia Freeland, what's your take on this big announcement? President Obama, 8.5 months in office. I'm sure even by his own account, he would not say anything, he's accomplished anything like he may hope to on peace and a lot else. But he has the Peace Prize. What do you make of it, Chrystia?
Well, I had two initial thoughts. The first one was, I wonder whether Republican political strategists are happier than Democrats about this, because it makes a great peg for arguing that Obama is a better U.S. president for the world than he is for Americans. It's a great way of sort of pushing that case about Obama. My second thought was that, in a way, I think that this award is an expression from the rest of the world of how much the rest of the world was waiting for an America which was open to multilateralism. Mm. And I wonder to what extent, and this might seem a very sort of FT-ish, wonkish point, but the shift that we had in Pittsburgh from the G8 to the G20 is really hugely significant. And I suspect there's going to be a lot of comment about Obama not having accomplished anything concrete. But I do think, again, more speaking from the perspective of Oslo or any other city not in the United States, that America feels to the rest of the world like a country willing to and interested in engaging in a multilateral dialogue. And actually, that's hugely important right now, not only on the issues of war and peace, but as we've seen with something like the dollar, on this really huge issue of rebalancing economic power in the world, which I think you could argue is the big challenge of the next few decades.
A very big signal out of Oslo. We'll see how it plays in the U.S. and around the world. The citation there, Jack, saying only very rarely has a person to the same extent as Obama captured the world's attention and given its people hope for a better future. And then this, here's Thorbjørn Jagland, chairman of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, announcing the president's Peace Prize today.
His diplomacy is founded in the concept that those who are to lead the world must do so on the basis of values and attitudes that are shared by the majority of the world's population.
There, the chair of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, Jack Beattie, a young president, still young in his own presidency, and a Nobel Peace Prize winner. Only Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson had it as sitting presidents in this country before.
Yes, and Woodrow Wilson got it after 8 years. He got it at the end of 1920. His dream of the League of Nations smashed, his health ruined, his presidency near an end. The League in Europe had turned into a vehicle for essentially punishing Germany. All his hopes were overturned. This is very different. This is a vote for possibility and hope, and for the redemptive power of words. After all, that's all we have from this man so far. And yet words have fired the hope of the world. And it confirms what we've seen in polls. There has been a dramatic gain in the prestige of the United States pretty much in every country in the world, with the exception of Israel, since the President Barack Obama has been in office. And this Nobel Prize, it sort of converts that into, makes that official. And I think further, it has all sorts of implications for our conduct going forward. It's inconceivable, to me at least, that a president who wins a Nobel Peace Prize is going to increase forces by 45,000 in Afghanistan. It's inconceivable that we're going to have some sort of military showdown with Iran. Not that that was possible even on the cards, other than in sort of the lunatic imagination. So I think it's going to mean something in the Middle East. I mean, our diplomat there, George Mitchell, has just been gotten essentially a stiff arm from the Israeli foreign minister. But this is going to, reinvigorate the peace process. So as a statement of possibility and as something that I think arms the president to do the right thing in a number of areas, this is a great moment for the country.
Christian, this is being widely interpreted as a kind of rebuke to George W. Bush, in that it's now when the leader, as they put it here, leads on the basis of values shared by the majority of the world's population, sort of sense that Europe maybe saw President Bush as not in that category. But also, Thorbjørn Jagland was saying after the announcement that, well, not everybody had accomplished their great thing when they got the prize. West German Chancellor Willy Brandt had the Peace Prize. The Berlin Wall came down later. Mikhail Gorbachev, won the prize, and much followed after he won the prize. What do you think Europe, the Peace Prize Committee, is exactly hoping for from Obama here, Christian?
Well, I do think that you're right that part of the motivation behind this prize is that Barack Obama is not George Bush. But I think another way of seeing that is it's also a prize, it's also being awarded to the American voters for electing Barack Obama. I think outside the United States, one of the things that was the hardest for public opinion to grapple with was the second term election of George Bush. And particularly, that the war in Iraq had already begun. Mm. There were already many concerns about grave human rights abuses. And I think outside the United States, there was a real gasp. And many people felt, is this the America which we have believed in and which we are comfortable having as the preeminent superpower in this post-Cold War world? So I think part of the motivation of the award is saying, we are so glad that Americans have chosen a president with whom the rest of the world is comfortable having a conversation. And I think that is probably one of the motivations of the prize.
Jonathan Martin, senior political writer at Politico, joins us now from Washington. Jonathan, thanks for being here. What about the political implications of this? Does this work for the Obama administration? It looks like a great thing globally. Our national politics are something unique right now, Jonathan. How do you see this playing out for the administration at home?
Well, I can tell you it's already being met with great derision by many folks on the right wing who, frankly, see the Nobel Prize as being somewhat watered down and so politicized. I mean, basically, the view on the right is that this is a rebuke to the Bush presidency, as was the award to Jimmy Carter and to Al Gore. That said, I do think that average Americans, sort of non-political types, the people who aren't listening to perhaps NPR or watching MSNBC or Fox, but just workaday folks probably say, hey, this is a pretty good award for our president. Good for him.
I think a lot of average Americans listen to NPR these days. President Obama himself will be speaking later in this hour, and we're going to bring you sound of his remarks on the Nobel Peace Prize. Let's get a couple of calls. Aaron in Des Moines, Iowa. Aaron, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. I'd like to say that I don't think this prize is something that Barack Obama should be receiving right now, because I don't think he actually has done much of anything to deserve the prize, and I honestly don't think he'll do much of anything to deserve the prize.
What about the Nobel Prize Committee saying he is looking at multilateralism, dialogue as the way forward? We welcome that. Do you see that as an encouragement to a certain way of operating in the world, Aaron, at least?
Well, to me, it just sounds like a bunch of buzzwords. To me, I have to say that I agree with the criticism that they're just applauding him for not being George Bush, and that, quite frankly, is not what you should think about when you're trying to award someone such a distinguished and prestigious, you know, award.
Aaron, we've got it. Let me go to Alice in Buffalo, New York. Alice, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Mm-hmm. I've been so discouraged. I'm 93, and I thought history was just repeating itself with the Depression and war. And hearing about Barack Obama renewed my hope for the future, and I'll die happy.
Die happy with the Peace Prize around the neck of Barack Obama.
Yes,
the
because
medal.
Of the hope he inspires.
Alice, we hear that as well. Jack, there's the span right there from Des Moines.
Absolutely.
And Buffalo.
Yeah. And, you know, hope is a power. I mean, it's not like this is some inert matter. It inspires people to reach their ideals. And I think this is, you know, that is the realm where the president is at his best, where he's speaking about ideals, American values. And it's not nothing. It matters. It motivates people. And I think that every American traveling around the globe today is bigger because of this. This enhances us everywhere.
Let's hear a couple more thoughts on the president and the Peace Prize. Heidi in Rock Island, Illinois. Heidi, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I thought that when I heard that Obama got the Nobel Peace Prize, I started to cry a little bit, because I was just really, really happy that we have a president that recognizes what the world is, you know, kind of wants and needs and is looking for, and I think he represents a really hopeful. He's a hopeful symbol. And if we're, you know, as Americans, as U.S. Americans, if we're looking, you know, if we think Obama is how do I want to say this? You know, the comment that you said earlier about Republicans thinking that Obama is, that maybe this might work against him, that he's a world leader before he's a U.S. leader.
Jonathan Martin's question, yep.
I think that that's kind of completely wrong. I think that... we need a president that is a world leader because we're constantly somewhat going around the world and fixing a lot of problems.
A president who can be both. Heidi, we hear it, including tears at the news. And I thank you for your call from Rock Island. Let me get one right here from Lata, South Carolina. Edward, you're on the air.
Stunning news, and I don't know still exactly what to make of it. I guess to pick up on a few comments that I've heard from your commentators this morning, already everyone is forgetting the substance of Barack Obama's speech on August 1st, 2007, to the Woodrow Wilson Center, where he declared his own statement of American unilateralism and his own appetite for preemptive war, and I'm quoting, "I understand that President Musharraf has his own challenges, but let me make this clear. If we have actionable intelligence about high-value terrorist targets and President Musharraf won't act, we will.
I will not hesitate to use
military force to take out terrorists who pose a direct threat to America."
Yeah, definitely. He waving the threat right there. Other speeches are being cited as well, of course, at the same time, and it's all part of the picture here. Speeches about ending the nuclear arms, a speech reaching out from Cairo to the Islamic world. Jonathan Martin, a lot of talk, but also a lot of decisions to make this week. And the irony of the whole decision, the huge decision on Afghanistan, going on at the same time now that this is in the president's lap, this prize in his lap. I mean, they're meeting today at the White House, the dozen-plus Secretary of State Clinton, Secretary of Defense Gates, Susan Rice from the UN, Holbrook, Mullen, Petraeus, McChrystal, all generals, heads of the intelligence and CIA, and right on down. I mean, he's going to be sitting there with this news and this Afghanistan decision all right there in the room, Jonathan.
Well, there was one liberal commentator, and I can't remember who, but I read this morning, you know, nothing says Nobel Peace Prize like escalating a war. And I think that that sort of gets at his central challenge here is, you know, does he want to try and find a way out, or at least try and find a way to address Afghanistan in a less conventional way, i.e. more troops? Or is he going to stick with what he talked about through much of the campaign, through much of this year, and that is his commitment to sort of winning over hearts and minds in that country and trying to set up a stable Afghanistan? And I do think that this prize does put more pressure on him from the international community in the sense that, is he going to, again, escalate this kind of a war right after receiving this great peace prize? So I think there's almost a certain amount of irony to it.
There sure is. Jason in Omaha, Nebraska. You're on the air, Jason.
Well, hi.
Hi.
My first take on it when I first heard it was that it was kind of a posthumous award where the awarders of the Peace Prize were basically giving their endorsement, telling the world that this is someone you need to listen to, he's doing it right, and it kind of gives him the support that when he goes before the UN or another country and he says, this is what I think, and I'm a Nobel Peace Prize winner, so you really should listen to me. I just see this as an endorsement, and I totally agree with it.
A world endorsement, let's not call it posthumous, maybe preliminary. And it comes right up against the decision that has to be made here. And listen to this. Here's Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. This is with CNN, Christiane Amanpour, talking on Tuesday about the realities of Afghanistan and strategy for the war there.
The reality is that because of our inability and the inability, frankly, of our allies to put enough troops into Afghanistan, the Taliban do have the momentum right now, it seems.
Momentum and troop numbers and not enough. Who knows where he comes down? He plays his cards pretty close. But here's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi talking to reporters after meeting with the Obama's War Council. This is press speculation this week that she and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid may disagree on troop levels.
Let me just say where there was agreement that it's a difficult decision for the president to make, that we all respected that he was looking into every aspect of this, and that that we were again honored what he had to say. Whether we agreed with it or voted for it remains to be seen when we see what the president put forth.
Jack Beatty, that was some picture. Senator Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi came out. Harry Reid said, "We're all going to be behind the president, whatever he decides." Wasn't so clear yesterday that Nancy Pelosi felt the same.
It wasn't at all. For some of us, at least, the president's comment after that meeting that he couldn't envision taking troops out of Afghanistan, that wasn't the question, that came as a rather desolating thought. What is encouraging is that the administration is clearly laying a predicate for focusing on al-Qaeda. On Sunday, General Jones, the national security advisor, said there are fewer, perhaps, than 100 members of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. 100 members of al-Qaeda. We have 63,000 troops there and growing. And if they focus on what is in fact dangerous to the United States, then a different strategy can be framed. The conflation of Taliban and with al-Qaeda, I think, is rather reminiscent of the conflation of Saddam with 9/11 that we saw that helped panic the country into the disaster of the Iraq War. People are questioning whether that's a valid conflation today, whether it was in 2001 or not. And moreover, I think they're beginning to look ahead to buying out, which is, of course, what we did in Iraq, to buying out portions of the Taliban and perhaps even bringing them into eventually the government there, which, of course, is, of course, a further question, the government there, whose shameful manipulation of the ballot is now made evident in the U.N. Spreadsheet just out today pointing out that in one province, Paktia province, 212,000 votes were counted. The UN estimated only 35,000 people voted. This is true all over the country. This is the government that General McChrystal thinks we need to save via his counterinsurgency plan. And I think what we're seeing now is the administration is going to focus, no, it's al-Qaeda that's dangerous. We're going to focus on them and do what we can to train the army in Afghanistan.
Chrystia Freeland, how do you interpret what it means militarily, politically, if indeed the administration is going to try and hone a focus on al-Qaeda as opposed to the Taliban more broadly? What are the implications of that?
Well, I think there are two really important things to focus on there. I think that Jack is absolutely right that one thing that we may be seeing is an effort to define success in Afghanistan much more narrowly than it has been defined in the past, and an effort to say, look, we're not in the our job here is not to build a democratic, vibrant, prosperous Afghanistan where everyone has equal rights. What we're really looking at is U.S. national interests, and those are about getting rid of al-Qaeda. And I think part of what is driving that, we've been talking a lot about the Nobel Prize being sort of the specter in the room as this debate happens today. Mm. I think the real specter in the room is the number 9.8%, which is the unemployment rate. And I think the real issue driving the White House in all of this is really questioning how much appetite do Americans who are still losing their jobs have for fighting a really ambitious war outside their country. And I think what Jack has been saying is reflecting the fact that, you know, probably Americans don't have that much appetite. I think an interesting issue, and I would love to hear what Hillary Clinton has to say today, is buying off the Taliban, bringing the Taliban into government, raises a really important issue in terms of women's rights. You know, this is an absolutely barbaric ideology towards women. Hillary Clinton has put that at the center of her foreign policy. How do you reconcile that?
Big numbers out there, 9.8% unemployment, 40,000 more troops. General McChrystal reportedly wants on top of 68,000. Jonathan Martin, I want to get your political assessment of this. But let's listen to Senator John McCain here. This was on NBC's Today show this week. Of course, the former Republican candidate for president saying Afghanistan needs more troops and quickly.
I think it's very much at stake that the Taliban is making gains and that the situation is deteriorating. That's been made dramatically clear by the deaths of eight young soldiers over the weekend. Casualties are up. All indicators are that we have to reverse this trend, and we have to do it quickly because in the view of the military leaders, not just General McChrystal, but the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Petraeus, who designed the successful surge in Iraq and Afghanistan, are clear that if the Taliban returns, they will work with al-Qaeda.
Senator John McCain, Republican, in there right away to say we need more. Jonathan Martin, Barack Obama juggling dynamite here with unemployment and with troop numbers. What about the political surround of the decision being worked through this week?
Oh, it's so fascinating. And look, let's take the right first. I think what they're clearly sort of leaning toward is trying to accuse President Obama of walking away from his commitment in Afghanistan. That's what you see the Republicans on the hawkish right, at least, sort of gearing up for, that he is not going to follow through with his commitment, and he's going to leave American troops sort of stranded there without the resources they need. That's going to be a tough political attack. But look, from the left, he's facing similar pressure. The sort of dovish base of his party, especially in the House, is just going to have a really tough time voting through 40,000 more troops or even 20,000 more troops. Their constituents don't want this war to go on anymore. And I think a sizable number of congressional Democrats don't want to see any sort of escalation at all. So he really is caught in a political pinch here. He's going to take flack from either side, regardless of what he does. But I think what is going to be fascinating to watch, to keep an eye on, is those House Democrats. Sort of, can he bring them along if he does, in fact, want to surge more troops into Afghanistan? He's going to get whacked from the right either way, but I think what's going to be interesting to watch is his own party base and how much of a leash they give him here.
Jack Beatty, what about his options within the Democratic Party? I mean, Nancy Pelosi absolutely not signing off, at least in facial expression, on we're ready to salute if no matter what he decides.
Yeah, on the other hand, Senator Reid said we're going to back him no matter what he decides.
Right.
So I think that's the split there. I mean, I suspect that the Democrats really just want to kick the can down the road. None of them want to suffer for seeming to be soft on Afghanistan, whatever that means. And I'm afraid that means that the level of troops probably stays what it is, maybe gets a little, increases a little bit. The mission changes more to focus on retraining, and we hang on there. And it's that that worries me, because, of course, that puts American soldiers at risk. John McCain mentioned the 8 killed in this horrible incident in the outback. This kind of thing could happen, will keep happening. And the question is anything in Afghanistan worth that? Leave out all the billions. Is anything worth the loss of life? Is this war worth any of that? And the case, it seems to me, against that has been made so, redundantly by this corrupt government in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Not so clear necessarily in the Situation Room at the White House today. Let's get a call from Rockingham, Vermont. Jack, you're on the air, Jack.
I heard Senator McCain the last few days, and I believe, frankly, his ideas of what's the problem is nothing more than an exercise in senility. Frankly, we don't have 40,000 troops in this country. And you could put 500,000, like as we did in Vietnam, or 1 million troops in Afghanistan. You will not defeat these people.
I mean, we do have 40,000 troops, but what are you saying? They're not ready? They're not rested? What?
I don't believe. Right now, we have 1,500 Vermonters who are about to go over there, and we have had the highest per capita killed in Iraq on that little exercise, and we're fed up with it. I don't believe that. The regular army, either you have a draft, and if you really want to go in there, and we saw what happened in Vietnam, basically when we did all of that, or you're going to have to phase yourselves out of there. The British weren't able to defeat these people, and ask the Russians. They got kicked, too.
Yep. Jack, thanks very much for your call. Christian Freeland, what about the Europeans watching the Nobel Peace Prize being awarded and watching for this decision in the White House? NATO has a lot of troops there as well. If the Obama administration narrows the focus to al-Qaeda, whatever that means exactly, do you see NATO lining up with that, sort of shifting immediately into that gear as well and saying, okay, we'll go along and talk with you to the Taliban?
Well, I think that sort of narrowing of focus is consistent with what we've been seeing other countries do already. And that the comments that Jack made from Vermont just now I think were really interesting, reflecting this sort of public fatigue and public unwillingness to keep on fighting in Afghanistan. I think it's not just Americans who are experiencing that, but that is being felt even more in the NATO countries, you know, Canada, for example, that have troops in Afghanistan. I think that the willingness to sort of try to rebuild this democratic Afghanistan, rebuild is maybe the wrong word, is really gone. And the question is how dangerous is Afghanistan for the U.S. and the world. So I think it's really about this sort of narrowing of focus that Jack is talking about. And the calculation that the president is going to have to make is precisely that. You know, his nightmare scenario, of course, would be that you either pull out or don't have an Afghan surge, and then a year or two or three from now, you have al-Qaeda coming back out of an Afghan base.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, a Nobel Peace Prize for the president this week, and more baseball goes into postseason. The dollar way down, and late-night TV gets surreal. The Detroit Tigers, in an epic battle to make the playoffs, lose a heartbreaker to the Twins, 6-5.
The Minnesota Twins win their fifth division title in 8 years.
The fall may, and off that goes. The dollar falls to a 14-month low, and the fall may not be over.
Everybody and his brother is short the dollar. I don't think I've ever seen a trade this crowded.
And David Letterman goes confessional on sex with staffers, blackmail and extortion, his ratings surge.
There's a letter in the package, and it says that I know that you do some terrible, terrible things.
Surreal on late night TV. We're looking at a week in the news, a peace prize for President Obama, war council at the White House. Let's turn to health care for a moment, if we may. Here's Max Baucus, Senate Finance Committee Chairman, said he'll hold a vote this coming Tuesday to move forward with a health care reform bill. He said his committee had worked to hammer out good legislation.
The result is a balanced, common sense plan that takes the best ideas from both sides.
It is a plan that essentially implements President Obama's vision to improve America's health care. And it is a plan designed to get the 60 votes that it needs to pass.
Jonathan Martin, how do you read what's coming out here? The Congressional Budget Office gives it the green light on the cost side, though the numbers are huge. Are there the 60 votes? Is Olympia Snowe of Maine there in the Senate to vote for this package?
Well, she's very much still in play, and I think she's one of the few Republicans in the Senate, at least, that is still sort of being contested. The conventional reaction in Washington to the CBO numbers was very, very good for the Obama effort, for Democratic efforts to reform health care.
This is the CBO saying it came in under a billion.
It's going to save money, they say. Mm-hmm. Two very good metrics politically for this effort. Now, the question, of course, is can they cajole those red state Democrats, the South and Mountain West Democrats, to get behind health care? Are there going to be 60 votes? That's still very much an open question. But I think you saw a shot in the arm this week for that effort with these CBO numbers. If you ask folks in Washington, there is almost nobody here on either side of the aisle or in the journalistic class who thinks that the president won't sign something. All of us see him as signing some kind of health care reform. The question is just how comprehensive it is. There's just no way Democrats will deny him the opportunity to have some kind of a ceremony signing a health care reform bill. He will sign something. The jury is still out on the scope of what it's going to be.
Here's Republican criticism from Eric Cantor of Virginia on CBS Early Show, saying the CBO numbers don't add up to him. And the burden's going to fall somewhere. He doesn't like it.
The claims that we're saving $81 billion by spending $829 billion, you can say that if you want to go ahead and really rob Peter to pay Paul. And that's exactly what's going on here. Their way that they are expanding coverage is by taxing employers, is by taxing those of us who have insurance, and frankly, to the tune of $500 billion. And they're adding on top of that $400 billion worth of cuts to Medicare.
Jack Beatty, what do you see coming here on health care? Is the traction back? Is it enough to get something the president can proudly say sometime later this year? Here it is, health care reform.
He will be saying it. It will be a historic victory. And the CBO estimates, which do seem miraculous, I agree with Mr. Cantor. How can you spend $800 billion and wind up saving $81 billion over 10 years? Well, the CBO is known for its frostily conservative estimates, so they must make the numbers work somehow.
I mean, to be clear, there are taxes in here, and
yes,
there are
indeed
cutbacks in here, which that's how they do the math, at least
indeed
their math.
Indeed. And, before we celebrate this seeming achievement, it should be borne in mind that that refers to government expenditures, the control of government expenditures. That says nothing about the premiums that we pay to private insurance companies. There is still in this bill, because it does not have, in the Finance Committee bill, because it does not have a public option to compete with the insurance companies, there is no mechanism to force down over time private health insurance premiums. And that's the big sticking point here, it seems to me. And the sticker shock that many Americans may find is that the insurance companies who are going to be taxed various ways, medical device companies are going to be taxed, in effect, these are windfall profits taxes, they're going to pass those taxes on to consumers in higher premiums. This is a risky business for the Democrats.
Let's get a call on that front from Liz in Montague, Massachusetts. Liz, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you, Tom?
Pretty well. What do you see, Liz?
Well, I have a comment kind of about health care and about the Nobel Peace Prize and how they relate to each other. I was a little surprised to see him win, and I took it as being a really European perspective, honestly, because I don't really see the hopefulness existing in this country that much anymore, because liberal people like myself are disappointed by the lack of really pushing the public option and pushing getting out of Iraq, pushing Don't Ask, Don't Tell to be repealed. And the people on the right are, they weren't really buying in on the hopefulness at all anyway, but they definitely haven't taken on that general air of let's get stuff done and do this together. I mean, it's just been really depressing dichotomy between the right and the left. And so when I saw him win the Peace Prize, I thought to myself, wow, on a policy note, we're not really seeing him actually bring any of the stuff fruition. And I kind of viewed it as a foreign perspective, that kind of hopefulness, still feeling really jazzed about that.
That is very interesting, Liz. And
can I jump in on that?
Yes, please. No. Jonathan and Christian.
Jonathan Martin here. I was so struck by that comment. And one of the sort of things a lot of folks in Washington are talking about this morning is this notion that the world community might still be seeing President Obama through a 2008 lens. That's to say that he's still seen as this sort of candidate of hope and change, offering so much promise, whereas certainly in the political class in Washington, he's seen as much more of a mortal now, even a conventional sort of president. These 9 months in, it's sort of taken some of the sheen off of him, whereas he's viewed strikingly different, I think, overseas. And secondly, the caller gets at something that I think is very important, and that is just how much of a political Rorschach test President Obama, then candidate Obama, was last year. If you were a moderate who didn't like President Bush, he was someone that you could go to register a sort of protest vote. If you were a true believing liberal, then maybe you thought that he was sort of simpatico with you. And I think that he's disappointed folks on both ends of the political spectrum as president by not being somebody who is a pure liberal, but also by being somebody who is, you know, hardly a moderate.
Christian, I want to come to you on this, but listen with us, if you would, just for a second here first. I heard the tectonic plate shifting a little bit almost a week ago, Saturday Night Live last weekend, no conservative bastion, mocking President Obama in a skit for having done, you know, in the words of the sort of a comedian there, nothing, nada. There's a skit here from Fred Armistead doing an Obama shtick. It got a lot of buzz. Let's listen.
Now, last year I was elected with a mandate to bring this country change we could believe in. And as time has passed, it has become clear that this promise is troubling to some people. There are those on the right who are angry. They think that I'm turning this great country into something that resembles the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany. But that's just not the case. Because when you look at my record, it's very clear what I've done so far. And that is nothing. Nada. Almost 1 year and nothing to show for it.
And then it goes right down the list, starting with, I will close Guantanamo, I will get troops out of Iraq, I will improve the situation in Afghanistan, nothing, 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 check, check, check. Christian, that was the tone on the sort of relatively liberal Saturday Night Live a week ago. Now there's a Peace Prize headed for the mantle at the White House.
Yeah, and I would say, actually, I think Jack even, to some extent, has echoed this idea in his initial comments about the Nobel Prize, saying this is about hope, this is about rhetoric. One thing that I think we really have to not forget is Obama and his administration have been coping with a huge thing, which is not nothing at all, which is the financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And a year ago today, it was very plausible to say this could be as bad as the Great Depression. Now, it doesn't make a great soundbite to say, I helped us to avoid the Great Depression, but the reality is that is something which this administration has done and which I think this administration can take credit for, and it has sort of found a course where they were attacked from both the left and the right, say over the issue of nationalizing the banks. They didn't do that. So far, that has turned out to be the right call. So, you know, I think the financial crisis has been a huge fight. It has required a lot of political energy, and I think it's also something which is framing some of these other issues, particularly healthcare. So, you know, there is a within the administration debate right now. The financial guys in the White House are very happy with the with the Senate bill, and they don't mind so much that there's no public option there because they're really, really concerned about containing spending. Whereas the health focused people are concerned, and they're concerned about these sorts of coverage issues, which one of the callers was mentioning. So I think that one thing that Americans maybe have to get used to is America is a constrained power in the world right now. That sort of heady moment, maybe at the beginning of the decade, when America felt rich and unilaterally powerful, that is over.
Christian, let me ask you while you're on that front about the falling dollar, down about 11.5% over the past 6 months and some big swoons this week. A lot of Asian economies in particular dumping a lot of money in there to hold their currencies strong against the dollar in their position. But what's indicated by that? Gold at record high here. Is that an international vote of no confidence going on, or just a return to mean after people ran to the dollar in the midst of the crisis? What?
Yeah, well, I think there are a couple of sort of perverse and contrarian things going on here. One of them is that, you know, as you say, Tom, a big driver of the weakness of the dollar is perversely the growing strength of the world economy and growing confidence in the world economy. We had something very odd happening last year, which was as people got really, really terrified about what was happening in the world and even what was happening in the United States, the dollar strengthened because that was and still is one of the ultimate safe havens. So that's one of the things happening. I think the other thing happening about the weakness of the dollar, which we might not feel instinctively, intuitively, a weak dollar that feels like it must be bad for the United States. Actually, what's interesting to me is sort of sotto voce, quietly, I think there are a lot of American policymakers, a lot of American business leaders who are quite happy about the weakening of the dollar.
Because?
And it's been because it strengthens American exporters.
Mm-hmm.
And the most vociferous reaction to the weakening dollar has come from outside the United States. Particularly, we've seen the Asians and the European Central Bank really, really worried that a weakening dollar strengthens American exporters and weakens their own.
There was talk this week even of the dollar not being the international currency this week for oil trading. I mean, that sounds like, tectonic plates moving again, but not toward the United States.
Yeah, that has been around for a long time. I think that Ken Rogoff, who is a Harvard economist, had it absolutely right when he said, look, there are these conversations about the dollar no longer being the world's reserve currency.
Mm-hmm.
That is going to happen at some point. But in Professor Rogoff's view anyway, the question is, does it happen 70 years from now or 45 years from now?
Way down the road. Jenna in Norwich, Connecticut. Jenna, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yes, I'm just commenting on the Nobel Peace Prize. I'm actually happy he got it. I know that they didn't base it on our politics, for one thing, and what's going on in our country.
Mm-hmm.
But he's got a lot on his plate, and I would like to see another person try to deal with what he's dealing with. I mean, just besides our economy, unemployment, the wars, I mean, everything. I mean, he's got a lot on his plate, and in just 10 months, he has accomplished things. He's accomplished bills with a proper wage. I know it was named after that woman. I forgot her name.
Lily Ledbetter on women's wages.
He has accomplished things, and I mean, it would be nice if people would highlight those things instead of just trying to bash the man when he's dealing with so much on his plate.
And on the day that he's won the Nobel Peace Prize. Jenna, we hear it, and we're glad for your call. Thank you. Let me get one more right here from Montgomery, Alabama. Jim, you're on the air.
Yes. How you doing, John?
Pretty well. What do you see, Jim?
Well, I am for the new health care reform, and I'll be looking forward to some competition to the insurance companies. The main point that I'd like to make is that most people are under the impression that increasing taxes on whatever item, product, or service is going to translate into higher prices, and I would definitely disagree with that. And the reason that I would disagree with that is because if someone can raise prices on a good or product or a service, they would do so no matter what. And it just because something has an increase in cost, a company can't, in order, if they were going to be competitive for one, they certainly can't just turn around and charge someone a higher price.
So you're not quaking that you're going to have higher necessarily health care premiums as a result and say bring it on. One more, Omaha, Nebraska. Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Lisa.
I very much enjoyed your show
over the last
couple of weeks since I've gotten KIOS. I also wanted to comment on Mr. Obama getting the Peace Prize. And
are you cheering or booing, or where do you come down, Lisa?
I'm sorry?
Are you happy? Are you saying yay or nay?
I'm very happy. I'm very happy. I'm very excited. Friends of mine and I commented when Mr. Obama was elected, and I heard from pen pals of mine that are overseas that to the effect of they view America as that friend that has been dating an awful person for a really long time. and oh my God, we're so glad you ditched that jerk. And I think to a degree the Peace Prize is a reflection of that. I also think it's a reflection of the rest of the world's hope that we will join their community now and not be going off on our own and taking stances that they can't condone or support.
Lisa, we hear you loud and clear, and our clock is short. Jonathan Martin, I mean, you've got to give the man his due. He's won the Nobel Peace Prize.
Quite...
that's not nothing.
No, it's quite an accomplishment. But I think your caller makes a very shrewd point. I mean, I do think that this is something of a reward for America. I mean, the Nobel Committee is increasingly less subtle, and I think that this is a reward to our country for electing a president that they very much prefer and sort of enacting policies that they do prefer. And I think that we're seeing that reflected by this vote today. But it's fascinating to listen to your callers because I think it reflects where a lot of this country is. There's some pride, certainly, but there's also some puzzlement as well.
It's all there today and likely only to become more faceted with ironies as President Obama wades into this Afghanistan decision and Iran talks ahead. Not easy, but he's raised a flag. The world is saluting it today on multilateralism. Jonathan Martin with Politico, great to have you with us this week. Thank you so much for coming in today, Jonathan.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Chrystia Freeland at the Financial Times in New York City. Chrystia, great to have you as well. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jack Beattie, thanks. Have a great weekend, Jack.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.